This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, ever heard of the Connecticut bull, Osborne Dale Ivanhoe? No? Well, chances are that glass of milk you had this morning has just a little bit of Osborne Dale in every single gulp. But first, the internet era has changed a lot in our society, and one of the biggest changes is in the scientific community. Scientists who once conducted their research behind closed doors and then published it for review in obscure journals were suddenly exposed to an open platform where their work could be discussed and disseminated on a larger, more wide-ranging scale. For some, this shift is seen as a positive for scientific research and discovery. But as you'll hear today, some recent cases of excitement over findings have many in the community thinking about the state of science journalism. You can join us, 860-275-7266. You can go to our website, WNPR.org, and join the conversation. You can always join us on Twitter and Facebook, at Where We Live. Joining us in our studio is Patrick Scale, who's WNPR science reporter and the host of TheBeaker.org, which we'll be talking more about later on in the show. Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm doing well.
And welcome back to our show, Priya Natarajan, who is a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. She actually joins us from studios at Harvard University today. Priya, good to talk to you once again.
Hi, good morning. And excited to talk to you.
Well, and this is great fun. You brought this story to our attention, and I think what we'd like to do is maybe have you set up the story that's had a lot of your community buzzing over the course of the last couple months. It has to do with a new theory around the Big Bang and gravity waves. It's the sort of thing that gets people inside and outside the science community very, very excited because it gets us a little closer to that big question that you folks are always looking at, which is, where did we all start? Where do we all come from? It gets rolled out in a big press conference, and then maybe some holes get poked in the theory. So tell us the story first, Priya.
Yeah, so we had an extremely remarkable and momentous discovery, of course, if this holds up, that is. And this is the detection of signals from right after the Big Bang, as close as we're ever going to get to the Big Bang, actually. So what these signals are ripples in space-time. So space-time, this sort of four-dimensional sheet, which is what our universe is. And these little ripples manifest themselves as very faint spiral or corkscrew patterns in the sort of bath of the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is the radiation in the microwave that permeates all of space. And this radiation itself, of course, originates from much later in the universe. But right at the beginning, just not even a second, 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang, quantum fluctuations produce these little ripples in space-time that get imprinted on the microwave background. And the detection of these little ripples actually is the only way in which we can get that close to the Big Bang. And what information they give us is about a very, very early phase of rapid expansion in the universe that is referred to as inflation. So if these gravity waves are really there and they've been reported to have been discovered, then this is really corroborating this theory. And this theory is kind of a crucial ingredient of all our models of the universe because it smooths out the universe very, very early on. Our universe is actually very, very smooth on the largest scales. And it also impacts the shape of our universe, this idea of inflation it predicts. And these imprinted gravity waves, it turns out, as I said, they're manifest in the microwave background radiation that we've detected already. The microwave background radiation is well detected. It's the imprint of these little ripples on top of it that is at question here. So recently in March, the BICEP2 group announced that they had actually detected these spiral patterns, and it's called polarization. The issue here is that there are many other ways that you could generate these spiral patterns. And one of the key ways that it can happen is if there is dust in the Milky Way, our own galaxy. That can actually scatter this radiation and induce these sort of polarizations that could mimic this signal. So in order to understand how robust and how confident we are in this detection, the dust sieve, if you will, of the Milky Way needs to be characterized. So what one needs to really understand is, you know, a whole bunch of different frequencies, how the dust behaves. So that is needed to calibrate what the dust would do to separate it out from what the early universe is telling us. And that is really at the center of what's at issue here with the robustness of the detection. So the current controversy rests on how well these effects of dust have really been taken into account in the analysis. And the BICEP-2 team that operates a radio telescope on the South Pole, they don't actually have comprehensive dust data. And that will come later this year from the Planck satellite, which was launched in 2010 by the Europeans. So Planck will actually characterize this dust in a whole frequencies and really help pin down what the dust sieve actually does.
Okay, so this is, and this is a very interesting part of our story, as we talked to Priya Natarajan from Yale University, talking to us a little bit about science and how the work of scientists is disseminated these days. That's our conversation here on Where We Live. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I'm also joined by Patrick Scahill, WNPR science reporter. So what you're essentially saying is the new that was found about these little ripples, it is indeed a momentous discovery, but the way it's rolled out makes it seem to many in the lay community, because frankly, Priya, a lot of the stuff you just said goes way over my head. It makes it sound as though they've gotten to something, they've made a big leap in a way that you're saying, well, maybe it's a step forward, but there's a lot more to go before we actually say this is a leap.
No, I mean, I think the what's at issue here is that they have a detection. And the question is, how significant is this detection? Because it has huge, huge implications. So it would be an extraordinary claim. And so in science, to make such an extraordinary claim, ideally, you would need many independent lines of evidence converging and many independent experiments arriving at a similar result. And I think what's special about this case is that the scientific community is sort of debating and arriving at a consensus in full public view. So the enthusiasm is intense, both within the scientific community and for, you know, the public.
And you've written about this extensively, and we'll put up links on our website, WNPR.org. Patrick?
Well, Priya, I do wonder if there actually is a controversy here, right? So these are scientists who are putting out research that's done to a certain point, but no scientific research is absolutely finished. That sort of goes against what science should be. So what is the actual controversy here? Did they announce this too early? Was it premature?
Patrick, I think you really nailed it. So what it really is that all of science is provisional. So, you know, our best current understanding can always change. So the controversy really here really is the claimed significance of the result and whether the group that reported it was actually very careful and did all the checks with the available data. The fact that the dust data, comprehensive dust data, is going to be available very, very soon is why the community felt that perhaps they should have been more cautious in their claim.
But let's just think about why anyone in the scientific community would get out ahead and do what they did. Obviously, all researchers are looking for funding. They're looking for people to be excited about the research they're doing. They want to make sure they're able to continue to do their work at the polls or at Harvard or Yale or anyplace else. And so making a big announcement about anything, even if it's not as verified as perhaps the scientific community would normally want, this seems like, well, at least from a PR perspective, a pretty smart move.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pretty smart move. And, you know, and there's genuine excitement for the scientists on this team. I mean, that's really palpable if you see the press conference and the discussions afterward. The issue here is not so much, you know, whether you, as to when you share, is the process within the community. There's an agreed upon process of consensus building within the community. And I think, as you said in the opening, all of this consensus building, when you have an amazing, extraordinary claim, this consensus building used to happen behind closed doors at little specialist workshops. And now all of that has opened up to the public. It's open to the public because, you know, you invite the press in. We're in a globally connected world. In minutes, the whole world knows about the announcement. I think the issue here is, how do we manage the fact that the results are provisional, subject to revision, refinement, and how the public can actually be involved and understand that process? As you know, I personally feel that this is actually good for science.
Priya, it's Patrick again. I wonder if there are any sort of structures that are in the scientific world, sort of within the scientific world. So I'm talking, I guess, specifically about journals here, and sort of the constant desire for scientific teams to get published in the most prestigious journal that's out there. And in some cases, sort of tailoring the research that they do and announcing it when they do so they can get in that journal and get that, you know, prestige that's tied with that. Are we seeing that in this case or in other cases, just sort of writ large in the scientific community?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much that, you know, it's really curiosity that's driving the scientific enterprise, right? And I think that people don't typically target a particular journal before they get their results for publication. Of course, there are some high-impact journals and some not-so-high-impact journals, and scientists do want wide reporting. I think what is new here is the way in which the scientists themselves are starting to interact with the public sphere. So it used to be that, you know, you send out your article for peer review to a journal, and the high impact ones, it's embargoed till the peer review process. You're not allowed to talk about it till the peer review process is finished. And then in combination with the journal or by yourself, then you have a press conference and you announce the results to the public. So, you know, this process has been evolving because, you know, the public is now in because of the internet, because of information dissemination, blogs, and the fact that we're now a much more open culture. So what's really happened is that the public is starting to see and get glimpses of this process, stages of this process that were opaque previously.
And you think, all in all, this is a good thing. Why?
I actually think it's a fantastic thing, I must admit. And I think part of why I think so is that the public really needs to understand the messy process of science. So there's this whole notion that science is this very clean, very objective way to produce fixed truths from nature. And I think we need to sort of dispel that myth. It really is a myth because science is complicated. It's a human endeavor. And yes, of course, it relies on objective facts and measurements that are replicable, that are made. So, however, the fact that the best current understanding in any subject changes can be very disorienting to the public. And I think this is sort of responsible. This sort of not understanding the ins and outs and the inside view of science is what is causing all the denialism that we see in America right now of science.
That's very interesting. But here's one thing that I just push back on that I think is a little bit different about our society, certainly in the world of social media. And I love your take too, Patrick. But Priya, this idea, and you keep using the word provisional. We seem to be in a society today that is less accepting of the provisional finding. If anybody says anything and it turns out to be wrong later, they're seen as a failure or a fool. They've spoken too soon. They've gotten out ahead of themselves. We're very, very quick to tear down those who don't get things exactly right at exactly the right time. And you know what I'm talking about. It's not just in science, but it's certainly our sports stars, our entertainers, everyone who's out there in the public eye, we're getting ready to tear down because they've made some sort of little mistake. I worry sometimes that seeing this messy part of science allows people to dismiss really great stuff because it's not 100% right at the time they announce it.
Well, I think that's a valid point, which is why I think in the piece that we wrote, I make the point that, you know, we have to come full circle on this. So the public needs to be informed now as this whole process unfolds in the case of the gravity wave detection. So as I said, many other experiments are going to come out with their results before the end of this year. So it's incumbent on scientists to actually keep the public informed, and so that the process actually is outlined for the public. So you need to close the loop. I agree with you that in this sort of soundbite society, we are very quick to dismiss something, very cursorily if it turns out to be wrong. And, you know, and I think in this particular case, I don't think it's going to be wrong. The question is, how significant is this detection? How significant is this measurement? So, you know, this is another aspect of science I think the public has difficulty comprehending is uncertainty in measurements, right? And what all goes into a measurement and how secure and confident you are when you make a measurement.
And I think just to maybe get a little sort of bigger picture here, we're talking about the universe, but I'll get even bigger right now.
Bigger than the universe. I like this.
I think the community of readers of scientific journalism, they want a takeaway, right? And I think our society sort of collectively wants a takeaway. We see that in all the TED Talks that are online. We want five things that we can say to someone over a dinner table that are cool and are insightful and that we think, irregardless of what the scientific research says, are true.
Yes.
And science doesn't really work that way, right? So increasingly, as you know, what Priya is saying, what we're seeing with the BICEP 2 team is that, you know, they do this press conference, they get up there, they say these things. It's provisional, but we kind of treat them like politicians. It's like Chris Christie at Bridgegate. He gets up there, he has to go in front of the press and just get flogged, and people say it's all wrong. It shouldn't be like that in the scientific community. It's sort of error is part of this process, and I think people need to realize that.
Well, in just a second, Priya, we're going to be having to join the conversation Virginia Hughes, who's a health reporter, somebody who covers an awful lot of science and an awful lot of the sort of science that Patrick's talking about that we want to talk about over the dinner table. Maybe I'll just get your take before this break, though, is what do you think would make for better science journalism? Obviously, more science reporters who've spent a little bit more time studying this stuff, but what else do you think would make for better reporting of the work that you and your colleagues do?
Well, I think one of the things that could really help is that, you know, we understand that science reporters want to cash in on the excitement, but, you know, being able to describe the process of how the result was arrived at and what the caveats are. Because, you know, as scientists, we have to mention the caveats in the work. And I think in reporting, it would be nice if reporters were more responsible and careful in sort of picking out not just the exciting result, but also the provisional, you know, sort of fleshing out the provisional nature. What is provisional about this? What could change? And have that part of the piece that they write. I think that would be enough, because then it would train the public to understand that, wow, this is really exciting, and let's see how this unfolds. So it's not a story, as Patrick said, that has a punchline that finishes. It's an ever-evolving story, and that's part of the excitement.
Ever-evolving, just like the universe. We're talking with Priya Natarajan, who's a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. She's written about this new world of science and science journalism, and it's on our website, WNPR.org. Also joining me in the studio is Patrick Scahill, WNPR science reporter and host of TheBeaker.org. Coming up, Virginia Hughes joins us to talk about her experiences as a health reporter and walk us through some of her challenges of modern science journalism. We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the art, not really the science, of science journalism. It's something that's changed a lot in the internet age. We've been talking about a big science story, about the Big Bang, but an awful lot about what you read is health science these days, the stuff that, for better or worse, tells us how we should eat, drink, or exercise, at least until the next study comes out. In studio with me is Patrick Scahill. He's WNPR science reporter and host of TheBeaker.org. Also joining us from Harvard University today is Yale's Priya Natarajan, who's a professor of astronomy and physics and got us thinking about this idea of science journalism. Joining us by phone now is Virginia Hughes. She's a science journalist in New York. She writes the blog Only Human, hosted by National Geographic magazine, and writes for other organizations as well. Virginia, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited about this because, as we were talking about with Priya, you know, some of the studies we read, and when I get a chance to sit in Ira Flatow's chair and host Science Friday, we talk about some of these studies around the universe. But the studies that we tend to read mostly on Facebook or Twitter, right, are the ones that our friends share with us. And they tend to say things like, eat more of this, eat less of that. And it always seems to say, drink more red wine, because that's what we all want to do in the first place anyway. But you've been thinking and writing a lot about this, Virginia, in your work as a health journalist. Maybe you can tell me the story of how you've been thinking about this, maybe in a new way, how we report on all of these studies that you've got to go through every day.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, I guess, I was thinking about, as reporters, we get access to some of the journals ahead of time, maybe about a week ahead of time. And so one thing I do when I'm trying to figure out what to say, write a blog about, is go through the press releases and the early study access and figure out which seems worthy of covering. And I came across this study about resveratrol, which is a molecule found in red wine and has been, for the last 10 years, everybody's heard news stories about how it may help you live longer and not get disease. And so there was this new study that came out that kind of threw some cold water on this. It was looking at people in the Chianti region of Italy, and in this region they drink a lot of red wine, and it looked at elderly people, over a long period of time, and they basically, the bottom line of it was that they measured levels of resveratrol in these people's urine, and then they looked at whether that correlated with any of their health parameters, and they found that there weren't any correlations. So there didn't seem to be any link between how much resveratrol they had consumed and how well they fared in their life. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, and maybe my readers would like that because we hear so much about red wine being good for us, blah, blah, blah. So I went to the New York Times website, and I put in resveratrol just to see, like, some recent studies that I could link to. And it turns out, I mean, it was like whiplash. For the last 10 years, every other headline was, resveratrol is good for you. No, resveratrol is not good for you. Resveratrol optimism, resveratrol fraud. It was like, it occurred to me that I wouldn't be throwing some new cold water on this topic. I would just be kind of perpetuating the cycle of back and forth. And so I didn't really know what to do about that. So I ended up just writing about the problem in general.
Writing about the problem and also appearing on NPR's On the Media. You can find an interview with Virginia on themedia.org about this very issue. So obviously it points out a conundrum for you. It's not just resveratrol, which is certainly something, as I suggested, we want to know a lot about because we all want to think that drinking red wine is a very good thing for us. But the same whiplash effect happens all the time, and it usually has to do with those very key things, the things that we eat, Virginia, and the ways in which we exercise. I know that there are other examples out there. What are we to make of all this? Because it seems as though almost every single diet or every single piece of exercise information is confounded by the next study that comes out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think when people have asked me about this recently, I say I basically don't believe anything that I read. We just had last week, I guess, Dr. Oz had a hearing in front of some congressional committee about the claims he made on his television show about this or that supplement being a cure or a miracle magic diet pill or whatever. And it's the commercial interests involved in health science are also just very powerful, whether it's a prescription drug like, you know, whatever, Vioxx, or even these supplements have huge market incentives. So I think one take home for the public is to be skeptical about everything you hear and everything you read related to health. And, you know, if reading a story about resveratrol makes you feel justified in drinking red wine, great, go ahead. I drink a lot of red wine myself, but don't take it to the grave with you. I mean, it's more than likely not 100% true.
Virginia, it's Patrick here. When I was reading through your blog, I saw that I think that maybe even the headline of the entry was something to the effect of, hey, doing science journalism is so confusing, there are times when I wonder if we should just give up. and I wonder if you can maybe just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I said almost. So I said I almost wonder. I that was sort of a cheeky way for me to start the post. I don't believe that, obviously, because a lot of medical research in this country is funded by public money, the NIH, the NSF, all kinds of public, our tax dollars are going into science. So I do think the public has a right to know what that money is being used for. That said, I think that meaning science reporters, health reporters, maybe cover too many health studies. Like maybe the most important step in our decision-making process is the decision of whether or not to write about something, not even how to contextualize it or all these other things that are very important, but just whether to give it any attention at all. Just because something is published in a new study doesn't necessarily mean it warrants the megaphone that we are effectively giving it. It's tough, though.
Well, Priya Natarajan, you've been listening through to Virginia here. I'm wondering how any of this strikes you. The world of the studies that you deal in are quite a bit different than some of the health studies that Virginia often sees come across her desk and the ones, frankly, that so many of us want to click on whenever we see it on Facebook or Twitter. Priya, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, first of all, I want to say, Virginia, I'm a great fan of yours. I think she made the right point that perhaps what is needed is a little more caution in the decision to publicize studies that, you know, science journalists have access to. In particular, in fields, as she pointed out, where there's a nexus of drug companies, there's a lot of money involved. For example, in my field, it's not so much about commercial interests. It's really about the individuals who are doing the research and accountability to the public, accountability to our funding agencies. And as I said, you know, sort of the sheer curiosity and excitement that the scientists themselves feel. I think what is really what might be useful, and particularly to my field, would be just, you know, exercising caution, explaining the context, and always making it clear that our understanding is evolving.
And this idea of the evolving understanding, Virginia, I think that this is one of the harder things, though, when it comes to writing about health, because people want something definitive. And I also think when it comes to human health, like what I should put in my child's mouth or what I should do myself, that it seems as though there's a little bit of a different bargain being made, whether it's with the journal or the science journalists, that you really don't want to give bad information that can hurt someone. Maybe, Virginia, you could talk about that, about how it really is different when it has to do with what someone's eating as opposed to, you know, whether or not gravitational waves are telling us something about the Big Bang.
Yeah, I was thinking about this when I was listening to Priya, you know, a few minutes ago in the sort of previous part of the show. I think that she's absolutely right about the key thing is that we need to sort of teach the public about the process of science and how it's, you know, it's provisional and messy. And I think when the public is reading a story about the Big Bang and gravitational waves, they might be a lot more sympathetic or, you know, okay with a back and forth. They might even be intrigued by it, like, oh, the scientists are, you know, it's a debate, and they look at this back and forth of them not being able to agree. But if they're reading the same debate about whether or not they should be able to have a drink while they're pregnant, and they've already done that, and then the scientists change their mind, the stakes are personal all of a sudden, and it does have more of a personal weight, I think. Now, that said, you know, people should have common sense. And I think anybody who makes all of their lifestyle choices based on what they read in, like, some news report online is probably a little silly. I think most of us don't make all our choices based on what we read. And I will say that, like, I think most of the mainstream media outlets that have dedicated science reporters are pretty good at contextualizing things, and they don't make outlandish claims most of the time. They might be too quick to cover something, but they usually have caveats up there, and the best ones will also note the financial interest. So I'm not a pessimist about this. I do think that it can be done well, and that people should exercise caution and skepticism.
And choose your sources carefully, Patrick,
yeah.
It seems, as opposed to those little clickbait boxes that are at the bottom
exactly.
of most of the Facebook posts that will give me five reasons not to eat this food, right?
Unless it's Dr. Oz, because I believe everything he
you
says.
You believe everything that Dr. Oz says.
So here's kind of my take on this as a science journalist who's been doing this for 5 months. So, Virginia, feel free to cut me off at any point. But as a journalist who's worked in other areas of the media and who's produced talk shows, I think there are predefined templates out there. One of these templates is sort of the news pyramid, right? So, and Virginia talked about this on the Media, actually. There's this idea that, okay, a new study just came out, so there's our news peg, right? We're going to write a science story based on that. We're going to give a little background, and then we're going to, at the end of the story, maybe give some of the implications of this research going forward. And sort of what that results in is kind of what no journalist should be doing, and that's essentially parachuting into the middle of this debate, kind of with no context, landing there, trying to map out where you are, kind of working out your own issues within the article, and then presenting that as fact to the reader. And a lot of readers aren't privy to all that behind-the-scenes stuff. They just take what's in the article as fact, and it perpetuates this sort of this kind of bad way of doing journalism. Now, most people aren't doing that, but a lot of people are. And I think, as you say, with these sort of clickbait headlines, these pithy things that are online to get clicks, that it sort of all feeds on itself. I don't know. Cut me off.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And that probably sounds just about right to you, Virginia, too. As you delve into these worlds, you've got a lot more experience in the study after study after study. And so when you write about the new one, you've actually got that little bit of background. There are an awful lot of people who, because it's easy to do now, are doing science journalism without a whole lot of background in science.
Yeah, and even within, the science journalism community, a lot of us tend to have sort of sub-beats within it. It's not absolutely necessary, but like I write a lot about neuroscience and genetics because it just gets easier when you don't have to learn the background again and again and again. You kind of like understand the issues right from the get-go.
I'm wondering, Priya, before we go, I really want to get to this point about market incentives once again. We talked about the fact that when it comes to, say, health care or health reporting, there's an awful lot of studies out there and people really care about what goes into their body. And this all makes sense. But because health and healthcare have become such an enormous field, it almost seems as though an awful lot of the research money, an awful lot of the money that would propagate information about new research is all going into this ever-expanding world of health, and it is not going into some of the other sciences, including the more obscure sciences that you deal with. Do you think that in large part this is part of the problem with science and science journalism today, is we're spending a lot of time talking about the things that we can make money on, things like health, and we're not spending as much money, I don't know, trying to put somebody on the moon or on Mars these days?
Oh, John, so you've kind of touched on my pet peeve. I absolutely think that, you know, the basic sciences are completely underfunded at this point. And I think actually this is disastrous for our country, for our economy, and for the world, because, you know, there's this whole notion, as you point out, that, you know, innovation has become tied in with the notion of a discovery or an invention that can immediately be monetized and can give you a product, be it a pill or some medical intervention, a diagnostic. And the idea that there are many, many basic sciences that need to be supported and the discoveries that may yet come from those are sort of hard to characterize today. I think that we are sort of losing our sense of priority and, as you rightly said, really skewed towards both in the health field and even in technology. When people talk about innovation, it's a very narrow definition of innovation, and that's sort of what's getting funded now. I really think that the basic sciences need to be funded much more generously than they are currently. They're really undervalued.
Virginia Hughes, what do you think of this?
I have some mixed feelings about it. I've written pretty extensively about this question of the basic science versus applied science within the biomedical community. So, you know, scientists who work on clinical trials, which are very, you know, applicable to, say, whether a treatment works or not, and then those who work on molecular pathways and figuring out why a drug works or why a disease crops up. I think there should be more money in all of it. Because I guess the counter argument is the sciences that are more directly applicable to people are the ones that are really going to kind of excite the public and get them invested in science. And we absolutely have to have that public investment and that public excitement in order to be funded, in order, you know, for Congress to continually give more money to the sciences. So you either need a basic science champion who is able to get the public excited about these basic science things, or you need the basic science to sort of piggyback on the applied. It's very complex, and I guess I'm trying to let's have it both ways.
But I'm wondering if just the huge market incentives behind, say, drug companies to come up with brand new therapies that people will want to pay big money for, if that just ends up skewing it way too much. Clearly, it's a lot of the stuff that we get excited about because it's going to help our health. But is there a way, Virginia, do you think, to bring this back into some sort of balance, save for a few big basic science champions like Priya Natarajan?
Well, one thing I think that could be done that would help a lot is partly because of that funding, those huge big pharma and all of that, we only see published the positive results. When a drug company does studies that don't show an effect and have negative results, those never get published. And so you get a skewing of the literature that always is for the breakthroughs and the positives. And outside of drug company funding, this happens as well. We don't have a scientific culture that values negative results as much as positive results. And so I think medical science, medical stories tend to be more of these rah-rah-rah than maybe the basic sciences are.
Priya, do you agree with that, this idea that we don't favor negative results as much as we favor positive results, maybe across the board, not just in health sciences?
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, speaking of for basic sciences, though, I think that's what I mean when I say the process has to be illuminated. Because in the basic sciences, when we write scientific articles, we have to say what sort of the wrong turns that were made, or if you make such and such assumption, you get something completely different that is incorrect. And so the process is described, but I agree with Virginia that perhaps, and you, that, more of the process of understanding itself should be part of the scientific literature. And it should be considered publishable, at least by the professional journals. I totally agree with that.
Priya Natarajan is a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. She joined us from the studios of Harvard University today. Priya, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, John, for having me on the show.
And also thanks to Virginia Hughes. She's a science journalist in New York. She writes the blog Only Human, hosted by the National Geographic magazine. Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, we're going to continue our science conversation with WNPR's Patrick Scahill. He'll tell us the story of a very special Connecticut bull who, well, he spread the love far and wide, leaving an important mark in the dairy industry. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, a few months ago, I was on a panel with Hamden Mayor Scott Jackson, and he said something that a mayor of a town almost never says. Maybe we've got too many towns. We'll talk to him about regionalization in the state that just loves its home rule. Plus, we'll look at Hamden as a test case for urban-suburban and town-gown relations. That's coming up on Monday's Where We Live.
He's alive!
Magnets! Oh!
Science.
Ah, yes, that's the sound of The Beaker, the science blog hosted by our own Patrick Scahill. He stops by Where We Live periodically to talk about the nerdy stuff that you can find on his blog, thebeaker.org. And today, Patrick, you've got the amazing story of a bull from right here in Connecticut who might well be one of the most important dairy animals of all time. okay, so tell us about this. Who is this bull?
So this bull, his name was Osborne Dale Ivanhoe, and we're going to actually hear a lot of sort of weird names. It seems like these cows and bulls have odd names. So anyway, as you said, he's one of the most influential Holstein bulls in dairy history. So what's a Holstein bull? Well, Holsteins are those sort of classic black and white dairy cows that you see in the milk bottles or on the farmer's cow ice cream that you buy at Stop and Shop. And Osborne Dale's story, it starts back at a farm here in Derby in 1952, the Osborne Dale Farm. But before we talk about the bull, we need to talk about the lady who bred him, Frances Osborne Kellogg. And we actually have a picture of her on our blog here, and she's wearing sequins and is very well-dressed. She was a woman who was very well-established in the dairy industry during the 1950s, and that was kind of sort of a rarity for women at the time. She was not related to the Kellogg family of cereal fame.
Okay.
But as I said, her family did have a lot of money, and she actually endowed the animal science program that's currently at UConn in Storrs.
Interesting. Okay.
So anyway, to learn more about the story, I went out to UConn. I met up with Bonnie Burr. She's assistant director at UConn's Cooperative Extension, and she said Kellogg was really obsessed with these Holstein cows, and as a breeder, she was very, very hands-on, to the point where when her favorite cows were in heat, she would actually go into the barn, and she'd sit there waiting to make sure that the right bull bred with the right cow.
And again,
just picture this very, very kind of well-to-do woman sitting on a bale of hay behind a cow, making sure that the Thai Vic Bowl had a rendezvous with Gay, okay? And that got us Ivanhoe.
So Thai Vic is Ivanhoe's dad, and she's referring to Aberkirk Gay, Ivanhoe's mom. So those are the two parents that sort of gave us Ivanhoe, this really influential bull.
We could probably do an entire show about the names. I don't know what's up with the names. So the great Ivanhoe is born. He grows up. What does he look like? I mean, what do the farmers think of this big bull?
Well, so we have a picture of him on the blog. He was really, really impressive. So I'm a tall person. Ivanhoe would have been about my height. He's about 6 feet tall. So I would have been a little bit taller than him, not to one-up Ivanhoe, but he was a big bull. He stood about 6 feet tall. He's very wide, very long, and he had what farmers call dairy strength, which is a very important quality.
Dairy strength. What exactly does dairy strength mean?
So the idea here is basically to get good milk production out of cows, which is something that farmers were wanting more and more. You need a lot of digestive tract to absorb nutrients and then to turn those nutrients into milk. So Ivanhoe was wide, he was long, he had a lot of that digestive tract. So he was appealing to farmers. And he was sort of in the right place at the right time because Francis was realizing that this thing called artificial insemination was sort of starting to revolutionize the farming industry. So today we all know what this is. It's used all over. It's used with pigs, cows, and even sheep. But back in the 1950s, as I said, it was kind of a novel thing. So Frances Osborne Kellogg, I think, you know, honestly, she was getting sick of just staying in the barn with these bulls. They're dangerous. They're 2,000 pounds. They're running around. It's kind of risky when you're sitting on a bale of hay and they're doing their thing. So again, here's Bonnie Burr talking about that.
So in the olden days, and even here at UConn, we would have a bull barn and we would leave, you know, a couple of bulls in there. And those two bulls pretty much serviced the whole herd for maybe a couple of years. And then you would have to move them along, you know, just for genetic reasons. With AI, what that opened up was the fact that you could draw from the bull and the bull would be spread nationwide.
Now, Ivanhoe had so much dairy strength that his genes were really appealing to farmers, as I was saying. And Kellogg realized that. So she got Ivanhoe sampled. And eventually his seed spread all over the U.S. and the world.
I mean, Patrick's using air quotes here. I think we know what you're talking about.
Okay.
But so through artificial insemination, now he's able to essentially spread his seed across the country.
Yep.
What kind of commodity was this? I mean, did this sell for high prices?
Yeah. So at one time, his semen was selling for $12,000 per unit. And these are very, very small units. So we're talking about millions of dollars that can be made off of one bull. And we are actually seeing that today with his descendants.
And that was a long time ago. I mean, real money today,
it's
right?
It's a lot of money, yes. So Ivanhoe, I called up the Kellogg Environmental Center. They kind of keep track of all this stuff. And Ivanhoe made the highest sire list for milk production for 8 straight years. He was honored at fairs in New York and all around New England. Some of his descendants even sold for record-breaking prices. In 1982, his daughter, and again, here's another fun name, Glamorous Ivy.
Glamorous Ivy, very nice.
sold for over $1 million. This was a world record at the time.
Okay, so I could see potentially some problems with artificial insemination.
Oh, yeah.
And they cropped up over time.
Yeah, so as you can probably guess, when you're spreading DNA far and wide, it's spreading everything, right? It's spreading the good stuff, the dairy strength that we talked about, but it's also spreading this bad stuff. And the bad stuff in this case started showing up in the late 1980s, about 16 years after Ivanhoe died. Cows were being born, and then for no reason, they were dying off. So to learn a little bit more about this part of the story, I called up Marcus Curley. He's director at the National Animal Disease Center, and he recalled a sick calf born in 1989. This was an animal, he said, that had a really high white blood cell count, and just to remind you, those are the cells that fight disease.
Typically, as a veterinarian, if you see an animal with an elevated white blood cell count, you know, you think there's an infectious problem. And so we went out and took a look at the calf. And, you know, he was just standing up there. He drank his milk every time we put a bucket of milk in front of him. He was doing fine, but he did have this elevated white count.
So this is a cow that, you know, seems fine and but has this elevated white blood cell count. So this was curious because they couldn't find a source of any infection. And when the calf later got sick and died, Marcus started to think maybe that elevated blood cell count was tied to a genetic disorder. So he started pulling pedigrees, and very quickly he saw a lot of those pedigrees were pointing back to Ivanhoe, this bull born in Derby. Now, like any of us, Curley's a busy man. He had a lot going on, and he was actually scheduled when he was doing all this work to go to a trip in Florida, a biology conference. So he decides to go, but he can't stop thinking about this dead calf, he tells me. So he takes all his paperwork with him, and while he's at the conference in Florida, he runs into this doctor named Donald Anderson, who's presenting on this condition called leukocyte adhesion deficiency, and this is an immune disease in children. And he's outlining all these symptoms that he's seen in humans.
And he proceeded to describe all of the defects that we had detected in this calf.
So bells start going off in Curly's head, and he starts thinking, well, what if this human disease is basically the same thing that I'm seeing in cows?
Oh, my goodness. So what is this mysterious disease doing exactly?
So if it's a genetic disorder, potentially the fate of the entire Holstein breed is at stake here.
Because
the big sperm banks really didn't know they were passing along this defective DNA from Ivanhoe. So cows are being born, they're sickly, and they're dying before they can mature. And Marcus told me that farmers were actually mailing him cows from Ohio and other places because they were dying and sick, and they wanted to know what was going on. So he started doing all these genetic tests on these cows. He sequences the genes of healthy cows and and the genes of cows that had died. And he comes across this thing that scientists now call BLAD. So this is bovine leukocyte adhesion deficiency. And he basically discovers two things. And first, the good news. It's a recessive trait. So that means a sick calf must inherit it from both parents. And then he kind of discovers the bad news as he's sampling all these cows. It's actually spreading really, really rapidly. It's all over the place. And at one point, he's sort of estimating that about 50,000 calves per year are poised to die.
And you multiply that number around the world, and there'd be over 100,000 calves a year that would have died from this condition had we not been able to, eradicate it, in essence, from the breed.
Okay, so let's just back up here. Yeah. What we're talking about is an awful lot of the dairy industry really at stake because of this one genetic trait of this very famous bull, Osborne Dale Ivanhoe, from right here in Derby. So,
absolutely.
So how is it eradicated? How do they wipe this out?
Well, so remember I said Curly was pulling all the pedigrees and they were sort of pointing back to Ivanhoe. Well, he still kind of needed the smoking gun on this, if you will.
Ah, yes.
And that's a sample, air quotes again, of the bull himself. So eventually Curly does get this.
We were able to get some semen, an ampule of semen from Ivanhoe, and we were able to confirm he carried the allele. And from our genetic testing on a couple of thousand bulls, as well as a couple of thousand cows back in the early 90s, we were able to basically trace all the carriers of this defective allele back to Ivanhoe and or his sire.
So put that another way, this bull born in Derby, the one with the super genes, the dairy strength, had one gene that almost sort of wiped out this very race of super bulls and cows that he had helped to produce. So luckily, thanks to Curly, the breed was saved. And now that scientists know BLAD can be traced back to Ivanhoe, they can actually mark the pedigrees today of his descendants to ensure that no two carriers of this recessive gene are mated together.
Good. So I'm glad they solved this problem.
Yes.
So now we can look at some of the positive legacies of this bull, Ivanhoe. How many cows today can be traced back to this one bull?
Well, so numbers on this are a little bit tricky, but here's what we do know. Ivanhoe had more than 100 sons that went into the artificial insemination industry. They spread their seed all over the place. And he had over 5,000 classified daughters as well. Curly gives us one more scientific take on this.
In 1982, Osborne Dale Ivanhoe had the highest what they call relationship coefficient to the entire registered breed. And in 1982, a published study on that suggested that about 10% of all the genetics in registered Holsteins that born that year could be traced to Ivanhoe.
So put that another way, that means of all the cattle that were born in 1982, about 10% of their genetic makeup could be traced directly back to this bull born here in Derby. And kind of what that means, just as a layperson, if you're drinking milk today, it's likely you've consumed a product that is somehow related to Ivanhoe, this bull here. So the one last thing I'll just say, if we're looking for a little bit more context on this, Bonnie Burr over at UConn says today Ivanhoe is still ranked in the top 10 most influential cattle in the world. And he had a lot of kids, as I was saying, and one of them is listed today, his grandson, Round Oak Rag Apple Elevation is his name.
They've got to come up with better names.
He is the single most influential bull in the world. There was a great article in the Washington Post about him that was written in the 1990s. In 1999, he was given all these accolades by these Holstein associations around the country. And it's estimated that that bull, Ivanhoe's grandson, spawned an estimated 8.8 million children and grandchildren.
It's really fascinating, Patrick, and it certainly makes me think differently about the glass of milk that I had this morning. But we just have about a little less than a minute left. But I'm wondering what you've learned in all this about the way the dairy industry works. It seems almost amazing and maybe not quite right that so much of this huge industry comes from so few dairy cows and bulls. It's I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense in terms of propagation of a healthy breed.
Well, from an economic standpoint, it certainly does make sense. I know at UConn, for example, they produce about 28,000 pounds of milk per year from fewer than 100 cows, which is just sort of a mind-boggling stat to make to make sense of. But if you're a farmer, right, that makes sense. Economically, you would do it, and certainly those economic forces drive people to do this.
If you want to read more about this amazing bull, it's Patrick Scahill's blog, thebeaker.org. You can find pictures of Osborndale, Ivanhoe, and much more. Patrick, thanks for sharing the story. I appreciate it.
Sure, John.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.